Welcome to Conversations with Big Rich. This is an interview-style podcast. These interviewed are all involved in the off-road industry. Being involved, like all of my guests are, is a lifestyle, not just a job. I talk to past, present, and future legends, as well as business owners, employees, media, and land use warriors, men and women who have found their way into this exciting and addictive lifestyle we call off-road. We discuss their personal history, struggles, successes, and reboots. We dive into what drives them to stay active in off-road. We all hope to shed some light on how to find a path into this world that we live and love and call off-road.
Whether you're crawling the Red Rocks of Moab or hauling your toys to the trail, Maxxis has the tires you can trust for performance and durability. Four wheels or two, Maxxis tires are the choice of champions because they know that whether for work or play, for fun or competition, Maxxis tires deliver. Choose Maxxis. Tread victoriously.
Have you seen 4LO magazine yet? 4LO magazine is a high-quality, well-written, four-wheel drive-focused magazine for the enthusiast market. If you still love the idea of a printed magazine, something to save and read at any time, 4LO is the magazine for you. 4LO cannot be found in stores, but you can have it delivered to your home or place of business. Visit 4LOmagazine.com to order your subscription today. On this episode of Conversations is a rock crawler, a promoter, a black belt, a family man, and a guy that enjoys a good time. Anybody that knows him knows who I'm talking about right now, and that's Todd Young. Todd, great to have you on the podcast. Let's start rock and roll and see what we come up with here.
Hey, Rich, I really appreciate this opportunity. Been looking forward to speaking with you for some time, and always good to talk about the sport and what's going on.
Yeah, so let's jump right in. And where were you born and raised?
Nampa, Idaho. About 8 miles west of Boise, the capital.
So you never really wandered out from there for any time, and you just lived in that area your whole life?
Nope, born and raised in pretty much the same area my whole life.
Okay. So what was it like growing up in Nampa at that time? I know that there's a real dichotomy in that town of haves and have nots.
Yeah, for sure. Where I grew up, till I was about 13 years old, grew up on the north side of Nampa, which anybody that knows Nampa knows that's kind of the rougher part of town. And believe it or not, knives being pulled, and I actually seen a few guns pulled, it was a rough neighborhood. And for a young kid, it was tough.
And so what was it like for you personally growing up in that kind of a situation? Were you able to concentrate on school, or was it like dog eat dog?
Well, I was overwhelmed. I was definitely overwhelmed, later on diagnosed with, ADD and all that nonsense. But I had a hard time focusing on school, and a part of it was, wasn't my environment. I had a great household. My dad was always a brawler, so I was born with the expectation that you solved everything with a good fist fight. But in those days, it wasn't about fist fights. It was about knives and guns, and it started to get real serious real fast and definitely overwhelming.
And so did you get a chance to participate in any school activities besides the knife fighting and fist fights?
I did soccer. I really enjoyed that. That was probably my best sport until later on martial arts. I tried my hand at basketball, and I did a little bit of baseball. Ended up sliding into first base and baseball. So if you think about that, you can overrun first base. You don't have to slide into it, but I chose to slide into it and break my ankle.
That's not good. So then was the martial arts kind of a way to help you focus? Did that happen?
Oh yeah, no, that was a saving grace for me. My dad noticed that I took a great interest in martial arts films and movies and stuff, and he saw that I had some interest there, and one of the gentlemen that he had gone to school with years before was offering up some martial arts class, and so at the age of 7 he got me into martial arts, and that was a big turning point.
And you're still in martial arts today, correct?
Yep. We're coming up on 42 years in September.
Wow. Okay. And how, you lived there for, like you said, the first 13 years in that area?
Yeah. In Napa, First Street North, I lived there for, time I was born until 13, about 13, 14, we moved out in the country, about 4 or 6 miles south of town. And that was a great change for me because different demographic, different crowd, and didn't have to worry about the neighborhood as much.
And that means a completely different school.
Yeah, well, it worked out perfect because at that age, you go from the middle school to everybody goes to their respective junior highs in our area. So that put me at South Junior High, which was a much better school than West Junior High would have been. So,
because of going from a rough area to more of a civilized area, you might say, did you have a problem? I know that some kids can get into being a bully. You never seem to be the type now, but did you ever have that? Or were you more of like the guardian?
No, I definitely had my bully situations. You know, I tell story on top of story, but you know, growing up on the north side of Napa, you know, I had knives pulled on me. I did see a few guns and then pulled on me directly, but enough to scare a person. But by the time we moved and I got into junior high, things were good. But you know, I chose to be a skater with long hair, and somehow I was a skater with MC Hammer pants and bangs that were down below my chin. So you can imagine what kind of attention that drew from the jocks and the football players and basketball players and all that.
But you could definitely hold your own.
Oh, I could hold my own, but there, one situation in point, I was in seventh grade and I had the whole ninth grade football team hunting me down before, after, and during school to give me a whooping.
Was that just because of your looks, or did you do something that caught their attention?
Well, I'd been at a dance, dancing with a gal, and some kid was, I don't know if he was a family member or an ex-boyfriend or what, but he was standing there watching us dance. So we move on the dance floor and change positions and continue dancing. And there he was again. So by about the third time we moved, I had enough. And so, I just gave him a nice shove to get him out from in between us. And next thing you know, it turned into I hated all Mexicans. And some good friends of mine, believe it or not, were on the football team. And they caught the rumor. And so then, you know, rumors spread. And next thing you know, I got the whole ninth grade football team hunting me down.
Wow. Hopefully that got resolved without too much bloodshed.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. We did have one organized meetup at the local gravel pit, and me and one of the loudmouths, we squared off, and by the end of it, he was bleeding, I was bleeding, but I think I gained a lot of respect by that one. So we didn't have any more problems with the ninth grade football team after that.
Right. Sometimes that's what happens. You got to stand your ground and prove your point.
No, for sure.
And that carries on to later on in life, maybe not physically, but just emotionally and, you know, that willingness to just to go the distance.
Yep. No, we teach that and preach that in martial arts. You know, you talk your way out, and if you can't talk your way out, you try to physically get your way out. And if you can't physically get your way out, then you have to fight your way out. And unfortunately, sometimes it has to come to that fight your way out.
Right. So then high school, or that junior high and into high school, things were a lot better from that point on?
Yeah, I had a few run-ins with some, you know, the once you're the new guy in high school, then of course the big boys got to prove their point, and so we had a few scuffles there. But shoot, by my sophomore junior year, it was pretty much known that just leave the goofy guy in weld shop alone, and you won't have any troubles. And by then, I was so involved with martial arts, I really didn't have time for after school sports. So it kind of worked out in the best in the long run. I do have some regret. I wish I would have had the opportunity to do some high school football and maybe some basketball, you know, looking back, watching my kids do it. I realize I missed out on a bunch, but you know, I did have my martial arts family, and that was huge.
Right. So then you in high school, you spent a lot of time in shop classes.
I kind of fell into weld shop. We did a vocational rotation, and I was signed up to be a mechanic because my dad had been a mechanic, and that just made sense, even though my dad had preached to me for years not to be a mechanic. But they did a rotation, and I come across the welding shop. Well, shoot, even in the rotation, they had us welding right away. And I'm like, well, this is way better than the mechanic teacher tells us we're going to do 1 year of classroom, and then we might get in the shop half a day by our sophomore year. And I'm like, well, this ain't the pace I want. I want to be hands-on. I want to be hands-on now. So I got lucky. I got you got to pick your classes, and there weren't many spots left. And ironically, through a fellow martial artist who had taken classes from Mr. Flowers in the past, he put the good word in for me and got me into that weld shop.
Excellent. And so you did that all through high school in welding?
I did. Yep. Did that all through high school. And by my senior year, weld shop was three periods. And then I was a teacher aide, and then I was a teacher assistant. So I actually had 5 hours of weld shop by my senior year.
Were you able to get English credits for welding?
My weld teacher found out I was struggling in some of the English classes, and so he had to talk with the English teacher. And the next day, she handed me Cliff Notes on the book that we were working on, and she goes, "This is where I get all my questions from, and it'll be a lot more streamlined for what we're doing in this class."
Perfect, perfect. It was nice that they understood.
Yeah, no, I did have a good network of teachers and instructors through high school. It was great.
And you had a lot of support from your family, from your mom and dad?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I was, I was where I was supposed to be when I was supposed to be there and, you know, doing the things. They knew at 16, you know, I was drinking and doing what young men do. And you know, they weren't naive to it. They were young themselves, and it got to the point, if they were leaving town, they check with me and see if they needed to round up any booze for the party on the weekend.
There's some similarity there, my friend. There's some similarities. So then after high school, what happened?
I couldn't wait to go to work. I was... I've been in the kitchen at a local Italian restaurant from 14 until 18 years old. I'd worked my way up to head chef. But about halfway through my senior year, I got a position at a local, airplane facility, Avid Aircraft. They built kit planes, fabric planes. And, I got to go in and do some paperwork, and I got to go in and clean up around the weld shop, and I got to help in the shipping department. You know, I only after school got a couple hours in, but I had my foot in the door and I had my eyes on that weld shop. So as soon as I graduated, sure enough, I went full time.
And how long were you there?
2 years, a little over 2 years. Unfortunately, there was some stiff competition in the Avid Aircraft where I worked was in Caldwell, and here in Nampa, there was a place called Kit Fox, and those two had been direct competition for years and years and years, pushing one another. Well, eventually, some new companies down in Florida came out with even better product and better planes, and they put both of us out of business.
And so then what did you step into next?
Well, it was real interesting to be that young in the workforce and to have to try to collect some unemployment. And it took about 3 weeks of trying to collect unemployment, and I decided that wasn't the that wasn't how I wanted to live. So I went and got a job with a local grinder company, a place called Diamond Z. They build the big tire grinder, log grinders, you name it. These machines are amazingly impressive. And I worked for them for about two and a half years.
And so you were in like production welding at that time?
Yeah. Yeah. Big, big machinery welding. I went from, you know, minute 023 wire to 045 flux core vertical up. And I even got into the fuel tank department where I was welding fuel tanks together with 6011 and having to make them seal and hold pressure and hold ball of wax. So my welding skills, definitely the material that I was welding on had gotten bigger, but my skill level definitely had to improve.
Okay. And you said you worked there for, what, 2.5 years?
Yeah, about 2 years there. And a friend of mine, good friend of mine, we still stay in touch today. He was working over at a local truck repair shop, in a place called TEC at the time, Truck Equipment Corporation, and he was just loving it. He was learning hydraulics and electrical, and he every time I talked with him, he just raved about the place. I said, well, you ever get a chance, get me on over there. Well, they took on a big contract building the 2-ton bale wagons. They had 18 of those to build, and they were short-handed. So sure enough, he got me in the door, and I went on as a welder, and that just progressively snowballed into the same stuff, electronics and hydraulics. And the next thing you know, I'm specializing in stuff I never had any idea I'd specialize in.
Interesting. Interesting. It's interesting that you didn't, that you had so many jobs at such a young age, but all of them gave you a wealth of knowledge, correct?
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable. After the bale wagon thing, and that lasted about 2 years, building those 18 bale wagons. Our crew had the opportunity either to go on unemployment or stay there, but you wouldn't, you know, you'd be doing dope trucks and flatbeds and plows on the front of pickup trucks. And so I thought, well, shoot, I got enough of this knowledge of these bale wagons. I can probably figure out how to put a dump truck together. So I went right on the floor doing dump trucks and plows, and man, everything, you know, one thing just led to another. And I got a job. They handed me a job putting an underhood compressor on a new pickup truck. And to put this compressor on, you had to take about half of the top of the motor apart. And I was like, well, I'm not a mechanic, but this is kind of fun. So the next thing you know, I'm turning wrenches and welding and hydraulics. And I was kind of liking the turning wrenches. So even though my dad had fought me about it my whole young career, I kind of wanted to be a mechanic a little bit.
And that's what you do today, isn't it?
Yeah, we mainly do mechanics. I still fabricate a lot. Year before last, we did 78 flatbed installs. It goes in waves. Last year, we did like 15 service body installs. So it depends on what's popular in the area. But yeah, we do mainly mechanics now.
And are you working for yourself, or are you working for a company?
So I worked with that company for a total. Now, they did some ownership changes, and they did some name changes, but it was a grand total of a little over 11 years. And I just got tired of politics. I don't do rules and politics very well. I actually had a three-ring binder. And keep in mind, it's one of them fat three-inch three-ring binders that was clear full of memos and do's and don'ts of the company and policies. And I saved all of those, and I put them in that binder. And finally, at one stage, I worked at the end bay of the 16-bay shop, and I'd kind of gotten fed up with a few of the recent policy. So I wallpapered the whole back wall of the shop with all of those memos and stuff. And needless to say, the owner and the manager, they were a little upset with me.
So then your employment changed there?
Yeah, no, we had a 2-year spending and wage freeze, and they came to us. It had gotten so bad with company meetings, they actually would pay me double time to stay out in the shop and work while the company meeting would go on because I was stirring up so much crap. So they literally paid me double time to stay back and stay working. But they went from a spending and wage freeze to they were going to start charging us for the insurance that we were currently getting because their premium had gone up. And so my vantage point was, not only are you not going to give us more pay, is you're going to start taking pay away from us. And they didn't see it that way. They thought that they were being plenty fair. And I decided, well, I'm not going to play the game. I'm going to try my hand at doing my own thing.
And by this time you were married?
Yeah. Yep. No, I've been married for a couple years. And, you know, Marissa, my wife, everybody knows her. They wonder how she puts up with my shit. And sometimes I wonder the same thing. But she was always supportive. And well, I'll never forget, we were sitting in the hot tub one night and we were chit-chatting. And I'm like, man, I need to make the next step, but I'm nervous. And she's like, well, you got the knowledge and you're friendly enough. And she goes, you're successful at whatever you want to do. So, if you want to venture out on your own and try your own thing, nothing wrong with giving it a shot. So sure enough, that's what I did.
And so now you're employed by yourself. You're self-employed.
Yep. March will be, or excuse me, May 3rd will be 22 years self-employed.
Okay. And so you stayed in the same, though, genre of business. You're still mechanicking and welding and hydraulics and everything.
Yep. I opened up a company called Top Line Truck, and we do, you know, we started off early on, we were mainly mainstream, truck upfitting, a lot of septic stuff, a lot of dump truck stuff. Well, one of the local, all the local guys got bought up by a big company called Knife River here in the Northwest. They came through and they bought up all the local guys. Well, that kind of put the halt to a lot of our dump trucks, a lot of our service bodies and flatbed stuff, because Knife River had a shop of their own. So we had to step up and make a change. And believe it or not, that's kind of when we turned the page and started doing mechanic repair here at the shop. And it was kind of filler work, but now it's pretty much mainstream.
Perfect. Okay. And so let's talk about your family life, and then we'll get into how you got into wheeling. So you and Marissa, how old were you when you got married?
This is a funny story, but we started dating. I was 23. I had a house of my own. Had land. I was adult. She was 16 years old when we started dating.
Okay.
So the big joke is I was down at the junior high sticking licorice through the chain link fence, and she was the only one that came in to get a bite of that licorice, and I snuck in a kiss. So she hates it when I tell that story, but it sounds good. She was actually one of my karate students, and she had been in class when she was 14, and she was just a kid. I paid no attention. Well, when she came back when she was 16, she just wouldn't stop talking and hanging out after class. And next thing you know, I'm giving her a ride home, and one thing led to another. And I'm 23 years old, knocking on some little girl's front door to take her out to the movies.
How did that go with her parents?
Well, I found out, you know, after the fact, of course, her dad had a real good sense of humor, but no bullshit, double barrel shotgun leaned up against a chair in the living room, put the old fear factor in me, and it worked. I was gonna have her home by 11, but I had her home at 10:30 that night.
Smart man. So then, you started dating early? Was she 18 at least when you married her?
Yep. No, we. I got engaged. I asked her to marry me Christmas when she was 17, and that following November we got married when she turned 18.
Okay. Good. All right. And so then you have kids?
Yeah, 4 years later we decided to start having kids. We try to play it smart. Enjoy my middle years, her younger years. Keep in mind there's 7 years difference there.
Right.
And so we enjoyed a little bit of those younger years and stuff, and then we decided when we were a little financially secure that'd be a good time to start having kids.
And you have a daughter and a son.
Correct.
And
me and Theron.
Yeah. Exactly. And now she's on to college.
Yeah. No, that's been a hard pill to swallow. Nobody on either side of our family in the last few generations has been lucky enough to go to college. So been a big learning curve for us, for sure.
I remember both your kids when they were very young and coming out to events, and they were, quite rambunctious, would be a word to use, which I attributed to you being their dad, because you were always rambunctious, to say the least.
Oh,
but,
for sure.
But they've grown into, you know, I mean, great kids. I mean, rambunctious doesn't mean they're going to be bad at it by any means, but they're your daughter has been quite the athlete. And what's Theron doing?
He's the same. Anything he touches, he'll turn it into magic if he's got interest in it. That kid can out skateboard most of the pros back when I was skating. He would have made me look like a fool. He can jump on a scooter, he can jump on a dirt bike. We got a go-kart that he flips around in the shop. Anything motorized or with wheels on it, he's pretty amazing.
Awesome. And what is, what's your daughter's, what is she studying?
Mia, she's going to school, for a business degree, which she could get a business degree pretty much anywhere, but, she got lucky enough to get a little bit of a scholarship through ISU, Idaho State University. That's over in Pocatello. That's about 4 hours away from us. But she's on the track team. She's got a pretty good long jump. And she's actually pretty fast. She's realized at the college level she's not as fast as she thought she was. But she's definitely getting better. Second, they do indoor meets, which I didn't realize was as big a thing as it is. But during the winter, they do indoor track meets. A couple weeks ago, we got to go down to her first event, and she got third place at her very first college level long jump. So that's pretty impressive, and she's definitely inspired to run faster in her sprint. So she's a sprinter and a jumper.
What did you think of that indoor track facility there at ISU?
Oh, it's amazing. You know, I'd seen a little bit on television, but not really paid that much attention. But when you see it in person, it's impressive that, you know, the distance, you know, one time around the track's 200 yards, whereas your, you know, full size track is 400 yards. So, they downsize all the events a little bit because it is indoors. So, you know, the 100 sprint, which is her specialty, becomes a 60 yard sprint. So it kind of changes your mental game a little bit on how you approach that because you're not running as far, but you still have to be quick.
Right. Yeah, Rich ran there when he was in high school. There was a Simplot Games or something like that it was called.
And yeah.
It was pretty I was really impressed with that place, and the noise from running on that track was incredible.
Yeah, no, that's crazy, especially when they do those long distance runs. They got 30 guys on there. Holy moly. Sound like a herd of elephants.
Exactly. So then let's talk about how you got into off-roading. How did that all transpire?
Well, yeah, you know, like all of us as a young kid, you know, if it had gasoline, we wanted to go do it. But, you know, I tried my hand at mudding and whatnot. And that same gentleman that got me the job over at the truck equipment place, he had a Toyota 4Runner. And I just thought that thing was neat as shit. We had gone up on a little snow wheeling trip and that thing just could go anywhere and had a little 4-cylinder in it. And I was pretty impressed with the mileage he was getting and the places that thing could go. And it seemed like the ticket. So I couldn't wait to get myself one. So my dad's ex-partner over in Washington had one for sale. So I scooped it up and I got that 4Runner and I thought I was an off-roader like nobody else. So following weekend, I bought that thing. I headed for the hills and it was about this time of year. And I got into about a 6-foot snowbank and slid off the edge, and that 4Runner wasn't nearly as capable as I thought it was. So 5.5 hours of digging with a dirt shovel and new girlfriend that wasn't very impressed. And we were back on the road, headed back home. And a week later, I decided I needed to upgrade my 4Runner and found a new girlfriend because that one wasn't too impressed.
Did she help dig at least?
For a short time, then she was just cold and pissed off. But my dad, he took notice that I was kind of getting into the off-road thing, and they had a group that they'd go hang out with, some friends of theirs over in Washington, and they'd go hang out with the Yakima Ridge Runners, and they would do a thing over there called the Jeep Bowl. And I had heard about it. My parents talked about it for 3 or 4 years, and they're like, we got to get you over there sometime. Well, by the time I was old enough to drink, they invited me over, and I went over one weekend, and I was hooked. If it was 4-wheel drive, I wanted to be part of it. Those guys had mud pits. They had the Yakima Ridge Runners had a private spot over there that they had leased from the Indian Reservation. They had a hill climb. They had a mud pit. They had obstacle courses. They had everything set up. They had camping on site and showers. And I was on the search. My life's goal after that was to find something like that closer to home or make something like that closer to home. I wanted to be part of that world.
And so what transpired from that?
Well, as you know, you can't wait to get a rig just solely dedicated to wheeling. I didn't want to tear up my 4Runner because it was still my parking lot queen. You know, I beefed it all up and everything, but you know how it is. You're young and you spend all that money. You don't want to go out and tear it up. So my dad's ex-partner had mentioned these Samurai things, and we had actually gone over and picked one up from him and got it running and cleaned up. It was a hodgepodge looking thing. The fenders didn't match. The hood didn't match. The top was torn, but we wanted to hunt in the rig, and we went out hunting in that thing a couple times, and man, we had a blast and we were impressed at where that thing could go. And we got an idea in our head. We can fix these Samurais up and we can go show them Jeep guys over at the Jeep Bowl how it's done. So sure shit, here we are, you know, mechanics, fabricators, hydraulic guys. Let's throw some V6 Chevys and some Samurais and go whoop up on the Jeep guys. Well, we knew about torque and horsepower. We just didn't take in consideration axle size.
Right. Because those Samurais are very, very, very undersized.
Yeah. Well, needless to say, a 4.3 Chevy builds tremendously more torque than a 1.3 Samurai engine.
Right. So how much did you blow up that first time?
Well, I was doing good till my dad got stuck at the bottom of the hill because he didn't want to weld up his front end like I had chose to. And so super swamper boggers, stock Samurai axles with a welded front end. I crawl to the top. He gets stuck at the bottom. I turn around, hook onto him with the winch line because we got a whole group of Jeeps behind us now poking at us and making fun. So I try to pull him backwards up the hill and I explode both front burfields in one shot.
So then what was the next step after that?
Well, after they teased me about the my dad having a stiff winch line and trying to push me up the damn hill, we went home and we started buying, at the time we thought we were buying big boy stuff, but we were buying Dana 30s and Dana 44s and trying to figure out how to narrow and stuff those under the Samurais, and they were pretty good for a while.
And then you finally found 60s?
Well, it was kind of an interesting chain of events. I had Extreme Magazine had come out, and I got a copy of that.
XOM.
Yep. And I got a copy of that, and I started seeing those buggies in there, and I thought, you know what? I'm a fabricator, and I'm tired of tearing fenders off the Samurai and windshield frames, and we were starting to get pretty aggressive. We were breaking stuff on a pretty regular basis, but man, it was sure a lot of work putting that Samurai back together every week to go wheeling on the weekends. If I had just a tube chassis off-road rig that I could just beat the shit out of and not have to worry about putting it back together, that would be a lot better route. So I started building this tube frame off the pictures I'm seeing in the magazines and anything I can find on the internet. And so I'm about three quarters of the way through that, and some clowns out of California came up. They were going to move up here and put in a off-road shop just down the road from one of the biggest off-road shops. And we had heard about them and whatnot, so Shane Yost and Pepper show up to town for one of our off-road events, and of course they're trying to sell their business and everything. And sure as shit, there's one of the buggies I've been copying shit off of. At this event, it's Shane's old Razor chassis.
Okay.
And I said, well, hey, I'm building a buggy real similar to yours. And they kind of laughed me off and didn't really take me that serious. And I said, well, you know, this, that, and the other. I go, but I'm lost at a bunch of this stuff. I said, I don't know about shocks, and I don't know about, axle size and gears and. Oh, well, hey, we'll come over and take a look. So they got moved to the valley, and they get settled in about a month later. And I finally talk them into coming over to the shop, and I show them what I got started. And they're like, holy shit, you weren't kidding. You're not messing around. I said, well, like I say, I've got, but the rest of it I don't know. And I'd like some pointers in the right direction. Well, you know Shane, he was one always willing to talk and thought he had all the right answers. He sat there and, he helped me out. He got me hooked up on some tires and axles, and really fast discovered that Dana 30s and Dana 44s weren't nearly as strong as those Dana 60s. So there we go. We're in the buggy world with Dana 60s.
And is that about the time that you started spotting for him?
Yeah, no, it was an awesome time because I mean, the sport's growing, everything's going nuts, magazines are coming out of the woodwork, you know, and I got, Shane and Pepper, they're both excellent talkers, and, you know, they knew everybody in the industry, and they said, hey, there's an event coming up over in Goldendale, and Shane was going to spot for Hal Frost, if you remember old Hal.
Oh, yeah.
And he was going to spot for Hal, so nobody was going to be able to spot for Pepper, and Pepper wanted to drive the new Deliverance car that they had just finished building, and I could spot for him. I didn't have a clue what spotting was about, but hey, what an opportunity. So off we go to Goldendale, and sure enough, Big Rich and Little Rich, those assholes, they throw the biggest rock crawling soiree, I guess is what to call it. We had parties in the park, we had video screens in the park, we had a party in the park. We hadn't even been to the comp site, and I was already overwhelmed.
Your ADD kicked in.
Oh, yeah. And well, your son, Little Rich, comes up and you playing Flip Cup? And I'm like, oh, shit, I guess. And he pulled me right in. He's like, okay, here's how you do it. And it was off. And I'm like, this is my kind of people right here. And I'll never forget, it was Saturday morning. You're standing on the back of a flatbed pickup truck. answering questions and telling the rules. And I'm keeping in mind, I'm still trying to take in what the hell I'm supposed to even be doing, what I can and can't do. And I don't have a clue what a spotter does, to be honest with you. And you're up there, and my daughter, this, that, and the other, and if I catch any of you assholes looking at her, we're going to have problems. And I'm like, that's my kind of people right there.
Oh, Lord. the old days, yes.
Yeah, I'll never forget. The fact that you had all of these buggies that I've been looking at in magazines and watching videos on the internet are in downtown Goldendale, driving around town. I mean, that was back when the city was on board, and man, they you could drive. There were people driving up to McDonald's getting fast food and competition rock crawlers. It's just like, holy shit, where in the world does this ever happen? And I mean, I was amazed, phased, and dazed.
And from there, you were hooked.
I was hooked. There's no doubt about it.
And was that the same year, or is it later, a year or two later, that Moab came around?
That was the same year. That was the same year. We I had gone full bore with Shane. Shane and Pepper kind of had a little bit of a falling out. I think it was just they were kind of going in different directions, and the four-wheel drive shop didn't make kind of money they were hoping it was going to. So they were going in their different directions. Well, I got to jump on Shane's coattails, and that following season, it was a go. We were going to compete all season, do all the events, and I was going to be the spotter, and we were going to bring on sponsors, and he was already hooked up with Crane High Clearance. And so it was go time. So Globe Arizona, and then everybody went from Globe to Moab, and that's when Moab happened.
Okay. That's the first time I remember you personally. You know, the other events, there's just so many people there. I didn't get the chance to get to know everybody, but I think it was a night at Woody's.
Yeah, no, that had a lot to do with Marissa, my wife. She, we had a few drinks, and it was funny because before we walked into the bar, Shane tells us, okay, guys, we're sponsored. We need to act respectful. We've got our race jerseys on. We need to put on our best behavior. We're going to act like adults. We walk in there, and we're not in there 10 minutes, and Shane's hooping and hollering. He's got his race jersey off, and he's introducing me to everybody in the rock crawl industry, and I'm trying to take it all in. And so we're having a few drinks. We're feeling pretty good. Some song my wife likes comes on the speaker, and she jumps up on the bar and starts dancing, and your son's like, all my dreams have been answered. And so he's watching her dance and this, that, and the other. And she's about falls off the bar. Little Rich catches her. He goes to set her down thinking all of his dreams have been answered all in one shot. And I come over and I'm like, babe, are you okay? And he's like, what? And she's like, yeah, that's my husband. And you can see the disappointment just drain out of Rich's face. But yeah, we did everything but act like adults and act professional. That's for sure.
That happened in those days. The whole rock crawling scene was that way. It didn't matter where we went.
Oh, for sure.
It was a different time. We thought we were rock stars, didn't we?
Oh man, it was drilled in our head. It was the fastest growing motorsport in the world, and it was going to be all that and a bag of peanuts within a few years' time. All you had to do is hold on tight, and it was all going to pay off.
Yeah. And we held on tight, and it was a great lifestyle. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah, no, it's definitely stories to tell. Definitely stories to tell.
So then I know that you ended up becoming a promoter and putting on events yourself under the term X-Rocks. And
yep, Idaho X Rocks.
And when did that all start? And how did that come about?
Well, thanks to you and your son, you created that addiction in us. And I had a couple of hippie looking guys come over to my shop one day and they said, "Hey, you're that guy doing all the rock crawling stuff." I said, "Yeah." And they're like, "You need to come by my place." And it happened to be Tate and another good friend of mine, old Kevin Miller. They were doing projects and building up Jeeps and stuff over at Tate's shop. And "You got to come over to my place." And I'm like, "Well, what do you got at your place?" And they go, "We got a culvert." And I go, "You got a what?" And they go, "We got a culvert." I go, "What the hell is a culvert?" He goes, "We got a big round culvert we drive over with our Jeeps. You got to come check it out." And I'm like, "What kind of clowns is this?" So sure shit, I go over and, yep, they got a culvert and they're driving over in their Jeep. And that's when I first met Tate and Kevin. And Tate kind of took to rock crawling like I did. And I said, "Hey, you need to come check out one of these events." So he came to one of the We Rock events and he was hooked just like I was. And he goes, "You know what?" He goes, "I can get more culverts." And I go, "Well, get more culverts, but we're going to need rocks, this, that, and the other." So next thing you know, we're rounding up rocks and culverts. And we had thrown some fun crawls in the backyard for our local rock crawling club. And that was fun. But Tate agreed that, "Hey, these are fun, but let's go to the next level. Let's throw big events that maybe we can get some other competitors to come to." So we wanted to be like Big Rich. So we started inviting people and putting on little shows, and yeah, it just evolved. It went from 0 to 100 in about 2 years time.
And what did you think of your experience being a promoter?
It's like with anything, you always think, "Well, I got this way and I do this different and I do that different." But when it comes back to the fundamentals of rock crawling, I mean, there's really a couple ways to do it. You know, we left some stuff out, you know, flu, of course, and things like that. And we picked up some stuff from, Glenn doing the Calneva events and stuff with the extra bonus lines and switching some of that stuff up. So we kind of came up with our own set of rules. But, you know, when it all came down to it, it's the same game. It's just what little different quirks you put on it. But, you know, hats off to anybody that throws an event, especially a motorized event. And I don't care if it's dirt bikes or rock crawlers or speedboats. You're going to throw a motorized event. It's not the weekend of. It's 2 and 3 weekends before, and it's sometimes 2 and 3 weekends after.
Absolutely. And that's just for the event itself. That's not all the planning that goes into it.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and once you get to that level, as you know, advertisement and word of mouth and, you know, not stepping on toes and not overscheduling on somebody else's event. And that's just where we ran into so many complications down the road was, once everything started to grow and you had Oregon putting on events and Utah putting on events and then the We Rock events that we were always trying to avoid. And there for a time period that we had all that going on and Calneva. So it was definitely a dancing game trying to avoid other people's dates and plan a good date that worked for people.
Right. Yeah. It's not easy. It still isn't, even with less amount of events, because there's enough people doing crossover, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, for sure. I couldn't even imagine.
So then along the way, you were riding motorcycles and following Tate, I believe. And did you always ride motorcycles, or did that come along a little later?
Well, when I was a little kid, I had gotten into, believe it or not, when I was 3.5 years old, my dad got me a little Suzuki 50, and we had training wheels on it, and I'd zip up and down the driveway. Well, about 2 or 3 weeks went by of that, and I was over at my grandparents' across town, and I got my grandpa to take training wheels off my bicycle. And so I'm 3.5 years old, and I felt pretty good. I'd ride my bicycle without training wheels. So I come home and I march up to my dad and I said, "Dad, take my training wheels off my dirt bike." So he took training wheels off my dirt bike, and man, that's what I did for years. I ripped up and down that driveway, and even living on the north side of Nampa, I'm sure our neighbors really, really loved us, but I'd rip up and down the driveway on those dirt bikes, and I worked my way up to a Suzuki 80, and by the time I was 16, it was time to jump up to a 125 or concentrate on mini trucks and girls. Well, mini trucks and girls were a lot more important then, so I kind of got out of the dirt bike scene when I was 16. Well, later on, married and kids and family events, and I go up with the family and brother-in-law, and I got Tate yapping in my ear because he's got off to the side of his rock crawl course that we had built. He's got a full-on motocross track, so he's yapping in one ear, and we go up camping with Marissa's brother and family, and he brought up his dirt bike, and we need to run down, check on the kids. They had a bike that wouldn't run or something, so he goes, hey, jump on my bike, run down, and check on those kids. And I was like, well, shit, I haven't been on bike in years. He goes, well, just don't crash. And so I zipped down, and man, I had a blast zipping down and checking on those kids. So I couldn't wait to get home, and I buy me a dirt bike. So I went from zero dirt bikes to 2 months later, I had 5 dirt bikes. I had one for everybody in the family and 2 for me in case one broke down.
And that led to you becoming a pirate.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah, about a year and a half into it, I mean, we were single tracking, rock crawling, martial arts doing, family sport going. We had it all going on, and we were taking it all just as serious as we could. And big Hare and Hound dirt bike race was coming up that weekend, and all the top riders were going to be right in my backyard, and we're going to go out and check them out. Well, all my buddies were not available. And a friend of mine was going to be out there camping. They were going to check the races out too. So I thought, well, I'm just going to go ride around, find out where this guy's camped at, and maybe have a beer with him or whatever and say hi. So I'm riding parking lot to parking lot and exploring some new trails and found some new rock crawl trails out there. And I was feeling pretty good about my skill level that day. And I get down to this one parking lot, and I noticed that there's a red Duramax down there, and that's what my friend was driving. So I putt down there, and I get close. It's not my friend. And I thought, well, shoot, I've been riding. I looked down at my odometer, and I put on about 45, 50 miles on this old XR400 and thought, well, I put a pretty good ride in for the day, and I'm not finding anybody, and it's getting busy out here. So I'm in the main parking lot, Hemingway Butte, south of Nampa. Keep in mind, the big race is tomorrow. So you got all these kids out there riding, all the pros out warming up. I mean, this place is a madhouse. So I putt through these little kids thinking I'm riding back to my truck and maybe call it a day. I'm 3 miles up the road, and I don't want to crash into anybody, so I'm being observant. And I start grabbing gears, kind of picking my route, and I notice everybody's diving off the butte, and I didn't want to ride up the butte and crash into anybody, so I'm looking, seeing what I'm going to do next, and I kind of get my game plan in my head, and I look down, there's a rock about the size of a milk crate, and I thought, well, I can go around it, or I can ride over it, and I'm like, shit, I'm all geared up, I've been riding all day, feeling pretty confident, so I'm going to wheelie over this rock. Well, the front tire, it didn't pop up like I expected it to. It mogled over, and the back tire bucked me, and the bike went flying, and I was about 15, 20 feet in the air, and I thought, well, ditch the bike, get rid of it, and I'm going to karate shoulder roll this thing out. So I karate shoulder roll, wash out on the ground, and I'm sitting there. The whole parking lot comes running over, and I thought, man, what are all these people doing running over to me? And they're like, man, you hit hard. And I was like, no, I'm fine. It knocked the wind out of me, but I'm good. I'm peeling my helmet off and stuff. And one guy looks me right in the eyes, and he goes, you hit really hard. And about that time, I realized my tool belt that was wrapped around me was scattered from me to the bike. And I'm like, well, shit, I hit a lot harder than I thought. So everybody kind of disperses, and I kind of talk it off, and guy goes, well, let me help you up. And he grabs my hand, and I go to get up, and I'm like, ah, son of a bitch, I got a broken leg. So long story short, I get him to load me up in their truck, drag me down to my truck. Luckily, it was automatic. I didn't need my left leg. So I back up, go back to parking lot where I wrecked, get those boys to load my dirt bike up, and I start heading for home. Well, by now, my brother-in-law is headed out to the desert because I'd called him, told him I had a broken leg. He meets me halfway, and he's like, son of a bitch, I thought you had a broken leg. I'm like, I do. He takes me to the emergency room. They take my boot off, and my leg just flops to the side. It was broke pretty bad. So we should have gone in for emergency surgery then, but didn't. Monday morning, I go in. I had so much damage that I had a bunch of trauma blisters. So luckily, the bones didn't come through the skin, but with that, all the trauma inside created blisters on the outside. So they had to bolt me together from the outside, hold me together for a week while the blisters went down so they'd go in and do surgery. They went in, did surgery, lost count at about 34, 38 screws, somewhere in there, three plates. But I'm a fabricator. I thought, shit, we gusseted this up, we bolted it back together, I'm good to go. Week later, everything looked good. 2 weeks following that, it was fully infected going up my leg. So not good. So I went in, and they're like, man, this just got serious. And I'm like, yeah, tell me about it. The whole outside incision on the outside of my leg, about 14 inches long, was just mucus. The skin had been eaten and everything else. So they were like, what'd you have for breakfast this morning? I said, I didn't have anything. They go, good, because you're going across the street. We're going to do emergency clean out, so whole whirlwind of time. But I go across the street, and we do this emergency clean out, and I wake up, and keep in mind my hair's screwed up, and my whole world's just blown up. And the doctor walks in, and he goes, how was that? And I go, man, that sucked. And he goes, good, because we're doing it again tonight. And I go, what do you mean we're doing it again tonight? And he goes, there's so much infection in there. He goes, I couldn't get it all. And I go, well, what do we got going on? And he goes, I'm gonna try to get as much as I can. He goes, but I already had to cut the nerve for the top of your foot, so you're going to have drop foot. He's explaining all that to me, and I'm just like, holy shit. And so we go in for the second clean out, and I wake up from that, and here comes the doctor again, and he starts breaking it down for me, and I'm like, well, what do we got going on? And he goes, you've got those plates are saturated with infection. He goes, not only infection on the outside, he goes, but inside's twice as bad. And I go, well, what do we do from here? He goes, well, we're going to do a wound vac on you. So we're going to put this machine on there, and we're going to suck all the crap out of you. And we're going to put you on a bunch of antibiotics, and we're going to try to eradicate this infection. We're going to probably take 3 to 4 months to eradicate this infection. He goes, I'm probably gonna have to fly you to Salt Lake, and we're gonna take some of your butt cheek, and we're gonna put it on your leg. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. He goes, well, that infection's eating so much of your skin that, you're gonna need some skin grafts to replace that skin. And I'm like, holy shit. And they go, well, then what do we got? You know, I got martial arts tournaments coming up, and I got kids in soccer and sporting events to do and dirt bikes to ride. And he goes, well, if we can eradicate the infection and we get some of your butt cheek on your leg, he goes, in 3 to 4 years, you'll try to walk again. And I go, what do you mean try to walk again? He goes, well, he goes, I can't take the plates out till we get rid of the infection. He goes, then we're going to give you an external fixator. You'll be in that external fixator for about 2.5 to 3 years. He goes, and then once we get rid of the fixator, you'll start trying to walk again. I go, well, what do I got? He goes, well, I'm going to tell you what my customers that have kept their legs tell me it feels like. Said, it's going to look like, and it's going to be about the size of a football. I said, what, my foot? And he goes, yep. He goes, it's going to feel like it's full of glass shards. He goes, and every now and then, that big old football, one of them glass shards is going to come up and remind you that it's there. And I'm like, pain? He goes, yeah, pain like you can't imagine. I go, okay, but after 3 years, I'm 100%, right? And he goes, oh, no. He goes, I said, you're going to try to walk again. He goes, I go, what am I going to be doing between now and then? He goes, you'll be on crutches or you'll be in a wheelchair. And I'm like, my whole world is shrinking. I got a business to run. I got kids. I got sports. I'm like, oh, he goes, He goes, I'm just going to throw options out there, not to alarm you. He goes, or we can cut it off and I can have you back to work in 6-8 weeks. And I'm like, holy shit. And Marissa sitting there next to me, and we had already kind of discussed, because we knew things had gotten serious. We had talked about it, and she looks at me and I look at her and I go, well, I might have to amputate this. And he goes, I don't want to persuade you. I'm not here to persuade you, but I want to just let you know what your options are. And I said, well, I said, I'm active. Like I've got shit to do. And what would you do? He goes, funny you ask that question. He goes, your head nurse and your last clean out looked over and saw how bad your infection was. Cause he asked me the exact same thing. He goes, I didn't bat an eye. I told him I'd cut it off tomorrow. And I go, but you don't understand how active I am. And the doctor goes, well, he goes, I ride mountain bikes up by Cascade. He goes, and I snow machine in the winter. And he goes, I do a little UTV and stuff. He goes, I'm probably not nearly as radical as you are. He goes, but without a doubt, he goes, I'd cut that thing off. He goes, but there again, I can't persuade you to do anything. And I go, well, I don't even know what's next. He goes, well, he goes, might I suggest you talk to a prosthetic doctor? And I go, yeah, I think that'd be a good idea. So funny as can be, he goes over the corner, he takes his cell phone, he calls this doctor, and I'm thinking, oh, shit, I'll see a specialist in a week or two or whatever. He goes, all right, well, Mark will be over to see you in a little bit. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, he's going to come over from his office or whatever. So about 45 minutes goes by, and here comes this big guy, 310 pounds, and he comes walking in, street clothes. And he goes, hey, I'm Mark from Cromyla's Orthopedics, blah, blah, blah. What happened? I go, well, I was riding a dirt bike. And he goes, where were you riding at? And I go, oh, Hemingway Butte. He goes, I was just on my way to Hemingway Butte to go ride myself. And I'm looking at this guy, 310 pounds, 6'4". I'm like, you don't ride dirt bikes. He goes, bullshit. He goes, I ride OMC, the local motocross track, all the time. He goes, you're out in South Nampa? And I go, yeah. And he goes, you know Tate Elquist? I go, well, Tate Elquist is my spotter for rock crawling. He goes, oh, I ride motocross with him all the time back in the day. And I'm like, son of a bitch. So sure shit. And I'm like, well, hey, Mark, here's what I do and this, that, and the other. He goes, I'll tell you what. He goes, I'll have you doing everything you did before. And I go, yeah, but you don't understand this rock crawling thing. I mean, I got rocks to climb on and jump around and this, that, and the other. And he goes, I'll tell you what. He goes, if they don't make a foot for it, I'll build you a foot for it. We'll figure a way out. And I said, all right. He goes, but you need to make sure this was for you. And so I got out of the hospital. I went home and I did a week's worth of homework. And it sounds pretty dumb, but I want to see people doing simple shit. Like you can see people running, the blade runners and all that in the Olympics. And you can see people climbing rock walls and this and that. But I want to see somebody kneel down and take laundry out of a dryer. I want to see somebody going one direction and turn around and go the other direction. I want to see how proficient those things were and see if it was doable. And so, man, I hunted the internet and I searched and I found a video on just the dumbest shit, but I'm like, okay, daily life is doable and I'll figure the extreme sport stuff out. So I called the doctor up and I said, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and amputate. And that nurse, she started bawling on the phone and I'm like, are you okay? And she goes, that's the best thing you could have ever done. She goes, you just made my day. And I go, what's that supposed to mean? She goes, you're a great guy in a terrible situation. She goes, but I see these guys have been in here for 7 years, 8 years. She goes, one guy comes in, he's been trying to save his leg for 13 years and he's in misery. He's addicted to drugs. He's lost too much weight. He's just out of shape. His life's gone terrible ever since he's trying to keep that stupid leg. He goes, and for you to call me up and tell me that you're going to amputate. She goes, that's the best thing I've ever heard. And it just felt good to hear that from somebody that was in the industry and, you know, knowing what I was facing.
Right. And so then they scheduled the surgery fairly soon.
Yeah. So that following week I went in and they brought out the chainsaw and hack, 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 and she's gone. It still makes you nervous, though, when you're going in to have a leg cut off and the doctor comes in and he puts an X on your leg and I go, what's that for? And he goes, it's just so I make sure I get the right leg. So you're a little nervous going into operation knowing you're getting a leg cut off and they might screw up and get the wrong one.
So the operation went well, I take it. I remember, you know, seeing it on the internet that you were in recovery or in the hospital and had just had the surgery. And I looked at Shelly and I said, okay, I've got to send him, I need to send him a gift. And so we searched the internet and had it delivered.
Oh yeah, no, it was the best gift. And you of all people, I knew it was going to be something good. I just didn't know you were going to go to that extreme. But keep in mind, my shit's still casted straight. I had to be casted for 4 months straight and hopping around on crutches. And they gave me one specific thing not to do, and that was do not fall on the end of your cast. And sure shit, down at the rec center with the kids swimming, blah, blah, blah. I go to lean down to get a drink out of the drinking fountain. My crutches wash out from underneath me, and I pogo stick this son of a bitch right into the into the floor at the rec center, and it was one of those moments that just you feel like you failed yourself, you failed the doctors because you did the one thing you weren't supposed to. So I go crutching out of this rec center, and I get the front door, and Marissa's bringing the car around. She pulls up, and I got tears coming down both sides of my face, and I'm like, babe, I just screwed up. And I told her what happened. She goes, well, you got a doctor's appointment. 2 days, I'll check it out. So I went in, everything was fine, but I mean, it was just one of those, I'd been through so much and I was doing so good. And man, it hit me like a rock that I'd screwed it all up in one swoop. I did the one thing they told me not to, but so we're fighting through all that. I'm on crutches, the whole ball of wax. This package comes in the mail and Marissa goes, hey, this is from Big Rich. I go, well, shoot, I know there's some events coming up. Maybe he's sending out a schedule or something. And she goes, no, no, this is a bigger package than that. So she brings it in, and I didn't know what to expect. I figured it rules or something for a car or new requirements or something. I open this thing up, and son of a bitch, it's a pirate outfit, Halloween costume. And I'm like, that asshole. And so I inevitably, It was getting close to fall time, so sure as shit, it was all planned out. I was going to be a pirate, and I actually built a peg leg and the whole ball of wax to go along with it.
Nice. Nice. Awesome. I hope it brought a smile to your face.
Oh, and then some. Yeah, no, it was good to know that I had that, I had the support of that rock crawling community out there, because, you know, you realize real fast, and when those life-threatening or life-changing experiences happen, you realize that money and material things aren't nearly as valuable as friendship and family. And it definitely hit home that, you know, I had a family in the rock crawling community.
Yes. Yeah. And you always will. You always will. So then you continued to rock crawl, and you actually came out and won at Goldendale.
Yeah, I had had my prosthetic for 2 months, and we did the Cedar City event, and I was kind of up in the air on how well I'd do and blah, 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 and, you know, driving the car and getting around and moving around, but, you know, I was giving everything as much as I could, 100%, so I did Cedar City, and we did pretty good. And then we turned around, and it was going to be Goldendale, and Tate and I were on a pretty good roll, and things were working good. And man, we just had an amazing weekend, and we were ahead of Jesse Haynes, which was always one of those personal goals. Like, if we can be ahead of Jesse Haynes on day one, then we're sitting pretty good. Sure enough, we were. Jesse was unfortunately having a rough weekend, but it put us in pretty good standings. And we got to that shootout, and all we had to do was complete the course. But there again, that asshole Big Rich set up these gigantic boulders on this course that nobody had run these rocks before, this, that, and the other. The only saving grace was I got to watch everybody else go before me, and we picked our lines, but it was a scrape and a scratch and a throttle assault, and we got through that with, I think, 10 seconds on the clock, or I would have dropped to second place, and we came through with that first place, and man, what a feeling to pull off a first place after everything I had been through in the last couple of years.
And then to do it at the place that that first got the bug.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, to be at Goldendale at the most extreme conditions of Goldendale. And, I mean, there was no questions. I had done it, and I had earned it, and finally got to stand on that top pedestal on the podium.
And congratulations on that. That was a good weekend.
No, it was a good weekend and very memorable. And you and the landowners and, you know, everybody just made it special.
Awesome. So what's happening in your life now?
Just living. I mean, trying to find time to play and go and do. It just fell into place at the right time. I'd been shopping for property in the hills for years, and not serious, but finally I came across a good deal, and I ended up with two properties in the hills, and actually looking at a third now. But me and Marissa decided we're gonna build a cabin up in the hills, and so we started into it. And sure as shit, that's when coronavirus hit. So events went to the wayside, and businesses were closed, and business was slow, so it worked out perfect. Her and I, we did everything except the physical pour of the concrete. We actually dug the footings. But her and I and a handful of friends here and there, we put that cabin up in 8 months, from bare ground to finished product in 8 months.
And that's a log cabin, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It was a kit out of Canada, so you basically have your structure, but as far as electrical and plumbing, you know, you got to engineer and design all that yourself. And we had fun doing it and sure learned a lot. And it just, it was one of those things that was meant to be. It just, everything came together. We bought a lot of Craigslist and marketplace cabinets and whatnot. And we were on low budget, and it just came out sweet, and that's kind of our go-to now.
Most excellent. Love to hear that. So how old, what grade is Theron in now?
He's ninth grade.
Oh, he's ninth grade. Okay.
Oh, excuse me. No, eighth grade. Eighth grade. Sorry.
Oh, eighth. Okay. So he still has four more years.
Yeah. Yeah. He's three after this. So we're okay. We're counting them down.
Perfect. Todd, anything else you want to talk about?
No, I just great appreciation for everything you guys are doing. And you know, I'm not on Facebook all the time. I'm not a big social media guy. That'd definitely be my wife's job. But everything everybody's doing in the off-road community, I mean, from Ultra 4 to, you know, the dirt bike guys to the rock crawlers, I mean, just what an amazing family of people, and you know, see that some people are getting awards out there for their years of time and service, and the people behind the scenes keeping the trails open and trying to educate the public on how to properly use lands and land issues and try to keep as much open as we can. We, you know, we all see it locally and nationwide, these closures, and it's a shame, but, you know, it's one bad seed causes more problems than 10,000 people can fix. So, you know, I just encourage people to, you know, educate yourself and be aware of your surroundings and your impact on your environment. But, you know, hats off to all the behind the scenes guys and promoters like yourself and people trying to keep these sports alive and doing what they do.
Well, we appreciate hearing that. And I've always appreciated your honesty and friendship out at the events, and look forward to seeing you again.
Yep. No, we're going to hit two or three this year. And Mia's actually been hitting me up. She cannot wait to come home, and She doesn't care where we go. She just wants to go rock crawling. She says every time she smells a diesel truck or smells some race fuel, that's she just automatically goes into rock crawling mode. So the agenda this year is to hit a couple of events, and we're going to drag her along and make a family event out of it.
Excellent. Can't wait to see you guys. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for spending the time and coming on the podcast and talking about your life.
Yeah, definitely. And make sure you tell Shelly I said hi and give her a big hug and kiss for me.
Will do. And all say right. Hello to Thank Marissa you. For us. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Rich.
Okay. Bye-bye. Well, that's another episode of Conversations with Big Rich. I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you could do us a favor and leave us a review on any podcast service that you happen to be listening on, or send us an email or a text message or a Facebook message, and let me know any ideas that you have, or if there's anybody that you have that you think would be a great guest, please forward the contact information to me so that we can try to get them on. And always remember, live life to the fullest. Enjoying life is a must. Follow your dreams and live life with all the gusto you can. Thank you.